It's Will Sean Podcast. The internet cried out for two more blowhards, and they courageously answered that call. Armed with the weapon of wit, each week they're joined by guests to discuss movies, television, pop culture, and anything else that's pissing them off. Take it away, boys.
I'm Will Link.
And I'm Sean David.
And this is Will Sean Podcast.
Does a cop killer hide in the woods? How you doing, Will?
So, you know, this podcast doesn't pay the bills because we don't make anything off of this. And I have to go to work. And these people at work, they're constantly shaking me down for money lately. And it's fucking pissing me off. One guy was for Girl Scout cookies. And I didn't mind, you know, because I get to eat cookies. But this fucking guy comes in to work. He's not listening. And he wants me to give him money to sponsor his kid's football team to go to Hawaii. And he's like, you can give me $5. You can give me $25. I gave him $5. But I'm pissed off because do we get the money back if they don't make enough money to go to Hawaii? Why am I paying for this kid's vacation is what I want to know.
How many times have you been to Hawaii, Will?
Zero.
Zero. But this kid is getting a subsidized trip.
I am going, and by the way, he just came in with a piece of paper. It was like, oh, just like write your name here. And I want to come into work with a fund for the podcast. I want to hit up everybody at work for $5 to $25 for the podcast.
You tell them that you're raising money to cure chronic seriousness.
Yeah.
Yeah. And just with a flimsy piece of paper and an envelope and say, yeah, $5 to $25. I think it's a good idea.
This is no good. I'm getting shaken down. I don't like it.
And you're the Italian one. Come on, figure this out.
Hey, what's going on in the world of Will Sean Podcast?
Same old. I actually noticed we got a couple more iTunes star ratings, so thank you for that, and keep up the good work.
Keep it up, people.
Everyone, keep downloading. Tell your friends. It's Valentine's Day. I can't think of anything better to give your loved one than an emailed link to a podcast. Although, by the time you get this, Valentine's Day will be over, so...
Well, but next...
Next Valentine's Day. Wonderful. Fantastic.
Also, we had another iTunes issue this week.
We did.
Where iTunes did not update properly. It's there. I don't know. I've been in email communication with them, but this doesn't happen if you're a subscriber. So just subscribe already.
It's not that hard. We'd also like to wish a get well soon to friend of the podcast, Matt Taylor. I believe he's recovering from, what was it, gout?
Legionnaire's disease. He has some disease. He's in the hospital. He listens to the podcast. So, you know, whatever disease you have, Matt, fuck you. You're the enemy of the podcast.
The disease or Matt?
Both.
Okay.
Both
get well soon, Matt. And, you know, go Tigers, I guess.
Yeah, he's baseball in spring training. Who's the sponsor this week?
This week's episode is brought to you by the Bishop of Rome, Pontifex Maximus, Vicar of Christ, Sancta Sedis, the Throne of St. Peter's. That's right. For the low price of $19.95, you too can be the infallible leader of the world's 1.2 billion Catholics, Jews and Irish need not apply.
You're out.
I'm out, so are you.
You're out. Why are the Irish out?
The Irish, you know, they're...
Catholic.
The Irish. Come on, you just have to say it's the Irish.
Racist. Wow. on the show today, oh, look, there's another Die Hard movie. Who knew? Justin Bieber hosted Saturday Night Live. We're going to tell you what we thought on that. And the Grammys happened, and one of... Well, you know, we're going to have an enemy related to that, and it's an enemy you may be familiar with. But first, our guest today, terrific stand-up, funny guy, Eli Olsberg.
Hi.
Welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me, guys. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming out.
Absolutely.
To the show.
I love valley trips whenever I can do it. I call it going slumming.
Did you pack yourself a lunch?
I did not, because every time I do, I get robbed. I'm just kidding. I don't really feel that way about the Valley. I don't know. I think the Valley gets a lot more shit than it deserves, actually.
True. I agree. There's plentiful parking and yeah, low rents.
Exactly. And the Inland Empire, I think, is way worse between the two.
Although, there's the Valley, which is the area that's kind of pushed up against the mountains, and then there's the extreme Valley areas like North Ridge and Chatsworth. By the time you get 5-6 miles away from the mountains, then it's a whole different ballgame.
Yeah, it is. Van Nuys is kind of like the line of demarcation.
That's it. The Mason-Dixon line.
Yeah, it is, because there's a half of Van Nuys, what you were saying, the good half.
Yeah, there's the, where I grew up, Valley Glen was the gentrified portion of Van Nuys that butts up to Sherman Oaks. Everything else is just liquor stores and bail bonds places, so.
Yeah, I've been to Canoga Park, and that was pretty gross. But then Woodland Hills was nice.
Yeah, well, Woodland Hills, it's, you know, it's fancy out there. So I wore, you know why? Because there's a little bit of a business park there.
And Mulholland goes out there.
True, and you're close to Calabasas. So, wow, I'm sure everyone is fascinated by
what's
going on.
Yeah, sorry to just turn this to...
It's a travelogue.
We apologize to our one random listener in Poland.
You introduce a comedian, and then I might as well have just talked about the weather. You know what I mean? Like, that was insane.
I guess that is the L.A. equivalent of talking about the weather. Because the weather's usually nothing to talk about. It's usually the same here.
Sure, sure. But I feel like...
So you talk about the roads.
But I think the roads are fascinating in L.A. because they twist and turn.
We're going to do a whole special episode just on the Thomas Guide.
Yeah.
And we just go through everything.
So essentially this is an episode of the Californians.
Sure.
Well, let me ask you this.
Sure.
Are you so fascinated with this because you are not from Los Angeles?
Yes and no. I mean, part of it is that you're right. I'm not from LA. I'm originally from Southern Florida, which is ultimately way more boring than anything, even the worst place in Los Angeles has to offer, I would say. But also, I think what I'm fascinated by is that there's the Valley is the closest you'll get to people who are from LA and not usually looking to do the entertainment business. And that fascinates me because why live here, you know?
Accident of geography.
Yeah, I mean, I actually love this city. Even if I wasn't in the biz, B-I-Z, so to speak, of... I would still live here, but that's what fascinates me about it.
I always feel kind of, as a New Yorker, I always feel kind of ashamed how much I really like L.A. Like, I feel like I'm not allowed to.
Yeah, and whenever I talk to comics who move from New York to here, they're always like, most of them are like, they're like, I love it. I'm not cold. My apartment's twice as big. And, you know, they really love it. But then a lot of them, because they have to kind of start over in terms of comedy, that's the part they don't like.
They don't have a rat eating their face while they're sleeping.
Yeah.
I used to have that.
Did you?
Yeah.
Oh, New York's a terrible place. So how long ago did you move out here, and was it specifically for the comedy?
It was not for comedy. It was initially for writing, and then I got into comedy about a year after that. I moved to San Diego it's already been almost about 6 years, and then maybe a little less than that, closer to five, and then I've been in L.A. for a little over four.
Were you told there was lots of film writing to be had in San Diego?
No.
Anchorman, and you decided that's where you got to be?
I was like, this is where I'm going to make it as a newsman. And by the way, newsman is the real – that's what they really call it in the biz, not anchor. That's the consumer term.
Really?
No, I just made that up.
Oh, okay. Because I was going to say, I worked at a news station, but it was such a shitty news station that I thought maybe this was true, and they were all doing it wrong.
They were all doing it wrong. It doesn't seem like anyone in the news is doing it right, even those fat cats at CNN.
Brian Williams, I think, is the only one that's doing it right.
Really?
I think so. Although he always seems so sad.
Every time I watch the news, I'm just like, this is why people stop watching the news. You know, I always catch it on, like, when I'm at work or something, and I'm like, ugh.
Well, what I watch as news, I don't think is really news. I think I just watch commentary. I watch, like, Mad Ow, and I'm
like,
this is...
the Talking Head stuff. Yeah, so does one of my best friends does, and that's usually the intake I get. And even watching some of the Talking Heads, I get really, like, I could really use a gun in my mouth right now.
Yeah.
It depends.
I don't watch any 24-hour news stations. I can't do it.
Oof,
I get enough of it watching The Daily Show, and that's all I need
to
see.
Well, now they're taking in tweets. They're like, could send us your tweets.
That's
with
we
what
talked
you
about.
They don't want to do their own reporting.
Yeah, and I don't want to hear what someone else
has
to say.
They go, well, let's see what's going on Twitter right now.
Yeah, and they're like, send us your feedback. I forget the morning show on CNN now that does that. They're like, send us your talk back. And they're like, you know, this person says this thing, and I'm like, you know, I don't have much in common with most people, so whatever I think about it probably is not what they think about it, and because it's a Midwest, usually they get Midwest opinions.
Yeah.
You know, and I, a lot of people, especially out here, they're like, oh, you think you're much better than people in the Midwest? Actually, yeah.
Yeah.
If you really,
a lot fucking better, and I'm from Florida.
Yeah, exactly, originally from. That's why I got out of there.
Okay, so you do stand-up. Now, what drove you to get up on stage and... grab the mic?
It's something I wanted to try when I was like 19, but I didn't think. I was like, you know what, I'll just stick to writing and the other thing. It wasn't something that took the front lines. And then when I moved to LA, I was already a comedy fan to begin with, and so I already knew a lot about comedy, and I decided to check out more comedy while I was out here without actually pursuing it. And then eventually I was like, I had just gotten out of a relationship, always a great time to start comedy, and that's when I kind of dived into it head first. I wrote my first 5 minutes.
Was it about, like, the relationship?
Actually, it was not. No, okay. it was purely observational, because that's where most of my funny lines come from, is more on the observation side at the time. And I decided, I was like, you know what, I'll write 5 minutes, I'll try it at an open mic. If it doesn't work after this one time, I'll never do it again. Mm-hmm. It went well, about as well as a first-time open mic could go. I mean, my hands were still shaking. It was at the UCB. I was the last name drawn for the night, so I had to wait till the end.
Oh, okay.
And you're just sitting there, the anticipation and the nerves are just building.
Yeah, and it was like a half-and-half show where half the people had been up before, had been doing it for a while, and then the other half were, like, newer people. Some of the people that were on that mic I still am friends with.
I think it must be always – I recently did an – not a comedy open mic, but it was like an essay reading thing. It was a comedic essay, and I'd never done it before. And I did not want to be first, and I certainly did not want to be last. I guess you want to be – first time doing it, you'd rather be somewhere in the middle.
Somewhere in
there.
The middle, yeah. And I eventually developed a thing where I made it a point to always go up first, and I still do that now if I can.
Okay.
Because it's one of the harder spots. And sometimes in L.A., that's actually more the sweet spot because shows can run really long here.
Yeah.
And the later in the show, the riskier it is to lose your audience.
Now, you host a show at the Laugh Factory? Or what? Okay.
Yeah, so I host two shows.
Two shows, okay.
I host one at the Laugh Factory. It's every other week. It used to be weekly, except for
the Black Comedy Night, right?
Yeah. Chocolate Sundays.
Yes.
No, I actually host, it's called Dot Comedy.
Okay.
It's Wednesdays at 10. They're kind of, I think Kevin Smith is taking over one of the Wednesdays now, and then they have another Wednesday show called Fresh Faces they do at the beginning of the month. So right now it's every other Wednesday.
Okay.
You know, just on Twitter or something, you know, I usually post about it. And then I host another show with another comedian named TJ Miller at the Pleasure Chest, which is a sex shop in West Hollywood. And we do that every other week as well.
So many questions now. How did you become hosting a stand-up show at a sex shop? And are the comics like, is it a sexual – I mean, is it a lot of sexually – themed humor?
Not at all. It's just
so.
A stand-up show in a very unique location. I found it when I was this is going to open up probably another door too here, is that I host a podcast with Jake Weissman. Well, I used to. We don't anymore. But when we did, we had a performer on that was teaching a class there. They offer like workshops and stuff for like blowjobs and anal sex and dirty talk and stuff. And I don't remember which particular
workshop this was.
I don't remember which course this was, which sub-study, but she when I dropped her off, I was like, oh, this is a cool location for a comedy show. And TJ Miller, who's like very famous and very like you know, very very amazing and talented,
he's pretty funny,
asked me to, if I wanted to produce a show with him, he wanted to like run it with a newer guy, and I was like, absolutely. And the venues we looked at were kind of getting cold feet every time, and I just randomly was like, hey man, what do you think if we tried it at the sex shop, Pleasure Chest? And he's like, oh my god, yes. And then I went and asked them, thinking they were going to say no, and they're like, we're actually very interested in this. And they're like, but pitch us your game plan. And I did, and they were like, okay. So we do it every other week, and we alternate hosting, and TJ can, you know, get people that I couldn't get, that's for sure. We've had like Sarah Silverman drop in on the show, and
well, it's
going
to be a fun
and...
environment for someone like her to come down. Like, it's something different. It's something
absolutely
that you can have more fun with in that regard.
I think you and I are going to have to go stop by the show.
I have to, because I have this stuff fascinates me on many levels. Not just the comedy, but
the
I have
anal sex seminar.
Yeah, I'm going to teach a seminar on anal sex.
Well, it's
no,
a very like it's a very for her sex shop. You know, it's because it's in West Hollywood. They kind of pride themselves on sex positivity. So ironically, the thing that it does have an anything goes kind of attitude, and it is one of those things where like if you're comfortable enough to sit in a sex shop, you'll be comfortable enough to hear whatever comedians have to say.
I have many friends in the I have many dominatrix friends and stuff like that.
Yeah.
I'm always interested in anything. If we could have combined humor and anything sexual.
Dom and subs fascinate me.
Yeah.
It's a fascinating subculture.
Yeah, I talk – one of the performers we had on the – one of the porn stars we had on the podcast had mentioned that she was a dom, and she's like, yeah, I couldn't do it for too long because it was too exhausting, and I believe it 100%.
We had a girl on the podcast in the episode 8 early on, this girl, Nick Buxom, and she was a switch.
She back and forth.
And pretty fascinating. She's got like a webcomic on. It's pretty fascinating stuff. I want to ask one thing before, because, you know, we do have a lot of topics to go to, but I want to ask another thing about hosting a show. Like, if you host it, so you kind of come out there, you introduce people. I don't know if this is a stupid question, but how funny can you be? Is your job as host not to be necessarily funnier than the people? Is it to keep things moving? Like,
You know what's funny? At clubs outside of LA, that's a little more the case, is where you just kind of need to get people. I mean, even here, I suppose, you know, your job is to make sure everyone's shut up by the time you're done, you know, because people do kind of need that moment to get in, get relaxed, and set the tone. But I don't know. I find it a little different here, where you can kind of get people going right away. It's a little easier to kind of get everybody to relax. But there is still a little more, like, you know, you do a little crowd work, you do a couple things. It's definitely a different muscle. But, you know, usually about after a minute or two, you could start working right into material. You just need to remind people to tip the servers, you know.
This is extra business to throw in.
Sure, a little, yeah, promote certain things. You know, at clubs, more traditional clubs, like, you know, if you go somewhere like, say, in like Austin, Texas, or Fort Lauderdale, Florida, wherever, there is kind of more of a vibe of like, you remind people they have shows here certain nights of the week. Or is there a birthday in the house? Is there a bachelorette party? Those kinds
of
things.
Well, I guess also they don't necessarily have as funny people.
That's not true.
You don't think so?
No, not
like,
at all.
I mean, I didn't mean that to insult them, but I mean, like,
no, no,
I figure the
I get
person who hosts a show in L.A. is funnier than the person who hosts a show in Toledo.
Oh, that's not necessarily true.
Okay.
L.A., you have to understand, it's such a numbers game here that there, as for as many funny people as there are, there's probably triple the unfunny people. At clubs, it's a little different because they are more selective, obviously, and they have such a talent pool to pick from. So you're right in that sense that it's a lot – here it's a lot harder. But, you know, the thing that's – the advantage of starting in a city that's not a big city, or starting in a, you know, in a more regular town, is that because there is less people, they do want to foster that talent and kind of make that person the home base. You know, you want to have a couple of funny people around.
Yeah.
So they definitely have people. There's just less people, so that person will probably get
so
a little
more. So you mean like
more.
The big fish in the small pond as opposed
right,
to –
Right, exactly. Yeah, okay. Yeah. Because there's – I mean, you know, it's tough because every city's a little different. Like, you know, Chicago, Seattle, San Francisco, those are also areas where there's a lot of comics.
Yeah.
So there are a lot of funny people there. And they do scout for people out there as well because they want to try and snatch them before
and
they
bring them into
I have one question for you. You've done a lot of touring around the country?
Not or a lot. Not? I mean, a lot of it for me is kind of – it's more self-financed because it's a little – you end up kind of breaking even if you do go on the road. I've gone on a few times. I got to go to a festival in Chicago last June, which was amazing. I try to go up to San – you know, I usually go up the on the West Coast if I can when I'm on the East Coast in New
Pismo
York.
Pismo Beach, Paso Robles, all the big spots.
All the big spots, yeah.
Yeah, Hearst Castle, Anderson's Pea Soup.
Well, Hemet.
Yeah, Hemet, well.
Well, you know, but yeah, there are, you know, like San Diego, San Francisco, Orange County even. I mean, that is kind of the road in a way because it
like
is disconnected.
Brea Comedy Club.
Sure,
and
Brea,
Irvine.
Irvine. On the East Coast, if I can, in New York or when I'm home in Florida. Yeah, I try as much as I can. It's hard to balance it out with stuff that's going on here.
Okay.
But yeah, I get on the road as much as I can, which isn't super often.
So tell the people quickly where they can see you, where they can find you.
Yeah, you have a website. You have somewhere where they can see the dates of they want to come see your shows at the Laugh Factory or you or the Pleasure Chest or whatever.
Sure. They can go to, you know, EliOlsberg.com is my website. That's probably, ironically, the least updated thing. The best thing to do is go to either at Eli Olsberg on Twitter. You know, find me on Facebook on either Eli Olsberg or Eli Olsberg Comedy. Both of those link to separate Facebook pages. One's a fan page. One's just like a regular page. But I'll take either.
The website's got the little digging man that says under construction.
It actually is constructed.
Oh.
It's very well constructed. But it's no. It is constructed, but it just doesn't – I don't update it because I don't know web stuff very well.
But if you go to that, they also have the things to Facebook. And
to my YouTube page. All
and look,
stuff.
If you are a good listener of the podcast, and I know you are – you've already been to these things because we have it up on our Facebook page. So
awesome.
There you go. So you want to bullshit about some topics here with
Let's
us?
Let's do it, yeah. All if right. there's anything that wets my whistle, it's pop culture.
Well, then...
for me, it's Pop-Tarts.
Were you a fan of Die Hard?
I was, and I still am a fan of the first three. I'm very sad that this one's coming out because it looks like a direct-to-video movie with Bruce Willis.
It looks like a nightmare. There's a new Die Hard movie, and I didn't like the fourth one.
Neither did I.
Because I felt they took John McClane, who what I loved about him in that first Die Hard, and even through the first three, he was kind of just, New York everyman. Like
he was a working class cop.
Yeah. And then in the last one, Live Free or Die Hard.
Shooting cars and helicopters.
He's hanging on the back of a jet. That's where I lost all. And I had a little modicum of hope because I'm like, well, at least this new one's going to be R-rated.
Right.
But that's not...
And it became... What changed from the first three to the Live Free or Die Hard is major directors were gone. Because in the first three, it was John McTiernan did two of them.
Yeah.
Rennie Harlan did the middle one. This one, they got the guy who made the fucking Underworld movies.
That was for four, was Len Wiseman.
Yeah, Len Wiseman. And who is a very... I mean, look, I don't ever think a director is a bad director in terms of how they make movies. I think it's the content. It's never why, it's how. Right. You know, that's with any, I think, for art in general. But his movies have no, like, his Total Recall remake was very unremarkable. Like, that's the perfect word for
He's
it.
He's bland.
It
was, his films are all just bland and...
So he doesn't have any control over Bruce Willis, whereas the other directors, they have some kind of, like,
But also it was
like,
early. The first Die Hard Bruce Willis wasn't Bruce Willis yet.
It was like, can we take this guy from Moonlighting
and make him a movie star? Yeah, exactly. But by the second and third one, he was still...
He
let the director still take the reins, whereas in this one, he took it. And I'm sure most people know this, but Bruce Willis is a Republican, and the movie became much more right-wing.
Well, the director's John Moore, who I guess is also... He directed Behind Enemy Lines and...
Which is a very right-wing
Hitman.
Movie. Yeah, which is just a bad movie. That's not even right or left. That's just bottom.
One thing about the original Die Hard, and why it still holds up and why I love it, is that the script is so solid. Alan Rickman is... You know, they say the best Bond movies are the ones with the best villains.
Yeah.
There's just something so... compelling about that movie that you're into the story, you're into the plot. It's got great twists. The pacing is brilliant. The reveals are brilliant.
I will say the first is the best, but I prefer watching the second one.
I like the second one quite a bit as well.
I really do like the second one as well. I think it's a lot of fun.
The last act of the third one works for about half the movie, and then the last 20 minutes ruins it.
Once they jump off the boat
into Nova Scotia,
over. It's kind of, it reminds me. There was a thing, although I disagree with it. I forget who said it. Someone said, like, oh, Tarantino said this thing about Speed where he says it's a brilliant movie until right when the bus crashes into the plane. And then he kind of – I disagree. I actually love the movie from beginning to end. But I get what he's saying, and Die Hard with a Vengeance suffers from
that. You could say the same thing about Collateral, which I think is a brilliant movie until the last act when they're
running up. It kind of turns into a regular movie.
Regular movie needs his cell phones running out of batteries. Yeah. So this Die Hard movie, I don't know. It's 90 minutes long. It's getting
bad
reviews.
Yeah, that's the other thing. It's an hour and a half.
And – you look at it, and it just looks fucking drab. Like, it doesn't look... I mean, it looks like there's no color in the film. Russia has no color. Well, I mean, that's the whole thing, I guess. And I know they go to Chernobyl. But I know there's a scene in Chernobyl.
But Russia still doesn't feel like a character when you're watching it, and it also doesn't feel... It feels like one of those, like, Luc Besson-produced movies. Like a transporter.
Like a glossy Euro trash film.
It also feels so 80s for a villain, Russia.
Yeah.
You know, I'm just like...
Were corporations busy?
Yeah. At least with the other one, you know, even in the last one, the cyber terrorism was at least something that was relevant. And even though it was super, like, you know, this kind, you know, they had made it a point to wave American flags around, this isn't even going for anything. You know, I don't understand why they left the States, period.
Well, let me ask you this. Are you going to see it?
No. Not in theaters. I wouldn't pay money for that. And let me tell you something. I paid... for The Last Stand and Bullet to the Head, because those at least looked like they were going to be trashy in that fun way, like a more self-aware way. This does not look self-aware.
What did you think of The Last Stand? Because I also saw The Last Stand.
More Arnold, please. The villain was
villain's terrible.
Yeah,
he never gets out of the Sean. The villain never gets out of the car. Really.
Yeah, and they didn't. They could have stunt casted the villain. I didn't understand why they didn't do that. It was just this like. Random actor, like a model.
They could have had like a Gary Oldman or
they could have had anybody, you know, somebody I would even say somebody who was more cut from the action cloth, like from the 80s that we just don't, I mean, I can't even think of an example off the top of my head, but just somebody who at some point you could think like, oh, I remember this guy, Christian Slater.
Two words for you, Steven Seagal.
Perfect.
There you go.
Yeah.
Dud.
Well, you know what?
And he's fat, so you can just keep him in the car, and you'll just see that he looks like a pear now.
I kind of really liked The Last Stand because I was always an Arnold kid growing
up.
Too. Like, he was my guy.
Oh, I was never bored watching The Last Stand.
Yeah,
I actually enjoyed it.
It's a lot of fun, and I like kind of some of the, like, the Western stuff they played up with.
Yeah.
I thought it was they had fun with it.
I thought they did too. Forrest Whitaker really bad at his job in that movie. Like, he's the worst FBI director ever. He just keeps, like, guessing everything wrong. And I was just like, wow, this guy is going to not have his job when the movie's over.
I don't think I've ever seen a Forest Whitaker movie that I or performance that I've liked. He but rubs me the wrong way. Not even Last King of Scotland. He just does the same thing. I just have never been on board with Forest Whitaker.
I can. It's kind of one of those things for me where I could just. He's there.
Yeah.
Like I don't. I'm never like, oh, here we go, Forest Whitaker again. Mm-hmm. I'm just like, here he comes, and there he goes. You know.
Well. Sean, are you going to see Die Hard?
I want to see Side Effects first, and then I'll see what's going on
with
Die
Hard. See, yeah.
I have to see something to review this week, and I'm
I still
see
think you
Die
could
Hard.
Review this movie without seeing it.
Well, that's what ethics would I have?
Sorry, the golden code of the film reviewer.
Exactly. To actually see the movie, I would think would be the one code.
Do you guys remember when Ebert, I don't know if you know, he posted a 1-star review of a movie, and he said at the end of the review, he goes, I walked out 10 minutes in, and he had to go back and finish the movie because people were like, we won't, no fucking way.
What movie was that?
Called True Loved, and True without the E, I believe. I remember that very well. It's about 5-6 years ago. It wasn't like a huge movie. It was just, he gave it, I think, like a star. Or maybe even, I don't think he gave it 0 stars. I think he gave it 1 star, but he was like, this is really, really bad. This is really a shitty movie. It's terribly made. By the way, I'm just basing this on the first 10 minutes. It was the first time I walked out of a movie in a long time. He had to go back and re-review it to give it the full star.
Well, that's his comeuppance right there. He had to sit through the whole fucking movie again.
And it's funny because it's a movie that nobody saw. It was made for like 12 grand or something, maybe more, maybe less. But, you know, it was like a really low budget thing that somehow just made its way into Chicago.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't one of those things that nobody probably...
Wasn't a big studio release.
Right, exactly. Probably, you know, 1,000 people in the world have seen it.
Switching topics, do you watch SNL? Do you still watch
it? I do, but I watch it in DVR Hulu form after the day after. I usually don't watch it.
I very rarely watch it when it's on.
You mean you're not there at 11:30 ready to go?
I'm out having a good time at the bar, and I said, oh, fuck, I got 5 minutes.
And that shit starts like at 11:29. You got to be home for that.
It's honestly, my Sunday mornings are usually sitting in front of the TV, eating breakfast, watching.
That's how I
masturbating to a sock.
I usually, well, this one is actually, or sometimes if I do get home at 1 or 2 in the morning and I'm awake. And that's how I watched this week's. And this week, Justin Bieber hosted.
Yeah.
And normally, this originally wasn't going to be a topic on this episode, but I really did not enjoy Bieber on SNL.
I want to say something really interesting about Justin Bieber before we go any further. He comes to the Laugh Factory every other week or so. I think he's seen me do stand up once. Him and Selena Gomez, they sit up top. They get like security holds everybody. No one's allowed up there. It's a very interesting. Like Perez has reported that he's been there a few times now. That's Perez Hilton for all you listeners.
Yeah. For our Polish listener.
Yeah, he's a fascinating guy to me, but not – I've never – like, Taylor Swift, I've read up so much on because I'm more fascinated by her than I am by him. I think he's already been revealed, like, kind of as just he's turning 18. He's hitting puberty. His voice is getting deeper. I think he's trying to branch out now because – well, certain things are running out.
You know what it reminded me of? I mean, years ago, because it's not like I was an NSYNC fan or anything, and I was never like a Timberlake guy.
Sure.
But then I remember when Justin Timberlake hosted SNL, and I was like, oh, you can do more, and you are a talented, charming fucker.
That guy has a lot to offer, and I am completely on board. I think Future Sex Love Sounds was a brilliant CD.
Yes.
I can't wait for the 2020 experience.
Gonna go see the Jay-Z Timberlake stadium tour they're talking about?
If it happens, absolutely, because as soon as I found out that Palladium show happened, I was so disappointed that I found out about it way after the chance of getting a ticket.
Well, my whole thing with this was I was wondering, sitting down, will Bieber show me something? And he showed me nothing.
You know, he did show you his disgusting, awful tattoos and his Vanilla Ice spiky hair.
He looked like Vanilla Ice.
Yeah, he has an interesting... Well, what's interesting about him... See, the thing that Justin Timberlake and all these other people, they know their limits and they still play within him. Justin Timberlake does not go out of his way to play, like, a character. He doesn't put on... 250 pounds or becomes very skinny.
He's that Christian Bale.
Yeah, he's not that guy. He knows exactly what his limits are for music and for movies and for all that stuff, and that's why he does most of his things are very fun. He's only had a handful of dramatic roles, whereas Bieber's like, okay, I need to do an on-camera thing now. I guess it's time. You know, like he's just doing it because it's something that's expected.
Because his managers, because his people feel like you should host SNL, you need to show different sides of yourself.
Right, exactly. And so, whereas, you know, other people, it's something, it's clearly not something he wants to do.
But here's the thing, it's not like Bieber really stretched so far in SNL. He was just generally terrible in all the sketches and everything
did. Well, it's intimidating when you're, people forget you're dealing with these people who are really good at comedy and doing, when your live comedy is fucking terrifying.
Yeah.
I mean, even after, I still don't eat before big shows.
Well, that's part of the fascination, it always has been, of SNL. You know, it's bringing these outside elements in and having them fit within this well-oiled machine.
I'm going to say this, and I know some listeners, including Voice of the Podcast, Andrea Marchand, will not be happy about this. Bieber is charmless. He is charmless because other people like Taylor Swift, you mentioned her.
Yeah.
She hosted. I actually thought she did. She can't act, per se, but I actually felt like she did a really good job.
And she's the same, you know, she, like, cameoed in Valentine's Day, that really shitty movie, but she...
Oh, well, you don't need to tell me about Valentine's Day. Yeah.
But she, you know, she's in it for 10 minutes, and she had fun with her part, and it is that thing where she knows what she's doing. She's got a lot more of a clear game plan, but also, Bieber has been known to have fits.
Yeah. He used to be getting his way since he was 6 years old.
Well, not just that, but he has a very specific thing about, like, not just getting his way, I absolutely, but, like, he also has very strict rules, and when those aren't followed, like, you know, one thing is don't talk about his mom. That's, like, a big thing when he does interviews. Don't bring up my mother. Apparently some DJ did in, like, the Midwest or something, and he, like, threw off his headphones, just was yelling
at
the person
down
the hall.
And that DJ was subsequently a drone attack.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know if – I'm sure the guy kept his job.
That's why,
like,
we don't have Lincoln, Nebraska anymore, kids.
Yeah,
because Bieber had a hissy fit, and now a whole city in Nebraska.
Yeah. He pissed off, you know.
But I always try to remember also that I'm – their reality – his reality is not anyone else's.
Right.
Like, you know, more so, like, he really does not know certain things. Things and it's a weird line to try and I try to seek to understand that with anything.
But going back, do you think someone like Justin Timberlake's reality was so much radically different?
Didn't he have a kind of a tough upbringing though? If I remember correctly, he didn't. I don't think he had like a poor upbringing, so to speak of. But I think he was like raised by a single mom who wasn't as controlling.
Okay.
I don't think it was. You know, he has a very close relationship with his mother, but I think she's aware of sex and sexuality, and she's not trying to market one thing while he's off doing another.
Is Bieber gonna go the way of like Leif Garrett and these people? Like, are we not gonna know who Bieber is 10 years from now?
I think he's got too much of a machine behind him, at least right now.
Yeah, it's tough to say because music's also the wheel's kind of being reinvented right now with
how
people evolve and how people consume music. So it's tough. Like, this is the first time I think there's a lot of uncertainty for everyone, and I love it.
Well, you know, speaking of Bieber having fits, he had like a little Grammy fit too because he was not he didn't get nominated because apparently.
Where should he have?
I don't know. He thinks he should have. And he was actually going to host an online chat with his fans during the Grammys, kind of his little fuck you to the Grammys. But then apparently the server crashed or something. He couldn't do it, and he was complaining about it. But the Grammys happened. And this is an interesting award show to me because I really like – if you listen to the show, you know, I really like a lot of the award shows. I'm a big Oscar buff. I love all this stuff. I don't get as invested.
That's so cool on the Tonys, though.
I'm not big on the Tonys. Not big on the Grammys, probably because I don't feel a big investment in the music.
Are you into
industry.
The Bounty Hunter Awards at all? I know that's a real award show of some sort.
I
only if Boba Fett wins all the awards. And IG-88. He gets the Lifetime Achievement Award.
I'll do a whole... Let me tell you what. I will do a whole...
deep cut.
Hour on the Bounty Hunter Awards when they come around.
All right.
But the Grammys... You know, I guess I'm not that invested in the music industry.
Well, music's such a – it's not like where movies where you can kind of like condense it a lot more. Like with music, it is – actually you can condense it. For some reason they choose not to. I remember they did this thing where they I kind of watched it in fast forward. That's how I watch award shows. I DVR them and then I kind of fast forward. And I remember watching a part where they were, like, coming up tributes to, like, they're naming these bluegrass people and these other people. And they're like, and to Bob Marley. And that's when the crowd erupts. And I was like, you know, that's all you really had to say. Like, as much as this other guy could have had some effect on music in the 40s, nobody cheered. Nobody cared.
Yeah.
You got to cut the fat. And I don't understand why most award shows don't come in at 2 hours.
I still think – but you have to – I disagree, though. I still think it's important to – on your legacy. That would be like – That would be like the Academy Awards saying, no one watches short documentaries. Let's get rid of the documentary categories. Let's get rid of short
animation.
I don't think
they should get rid of them. I think they should just have a, you know, kind of like the technical awards. Because
the short bus awards.
But you know what? I feel like...
I think the Oscars actually should do that. Not for everything. I mean, I think documentary can stay in there, but, you know...
Sound mixing needs to go.
Yeah, sound mixing. Like, is there someone really sitting there like, here we go.
But is that, is that at this point because of unions and guilds that... that they have to...
I don't think that's... No, the Oscars, it is an award show, but the Academy has nothing to do with guilds.
But I'm saying, like, if we remove, like, editing from the broadcast, the editors, it's going to be an uproar, how dare you, this
no,
is
see,
our...
No, see, that's what I mean. Editing can stay. That's a big thing
but
for
fuck
a movie,
sound mixers.
You know?
But I don't know. I don't know much about the sound mixers.
No, but there is, like, these minor things that they always end up doing, and it's like, there are certain little things that could just be cut out and put in a technical thing at the, you know, that's not aired.
Well, the Grammys are more of a concert, I think, than an award show anyway.
Yeah.
I actually wonder if they should be at a different time in the year when they're not in the middle of all these movie shows, because I think there's a lot of other distraction, or maybe it's just
no, their ratings were fantastic. They did 28 million, which was the biggest since, like, the last time they did anywhere near that was, like, 7 years ago or something.
Well, how could they not with winners such as Mumford & Sons for Album of the Year, Gautier for Record of the Year, and Fun for Best New Artist.
Fun, period.
Yeah. Lowercase fun, period.
That's the one with the old dude with the crow's feet and the Mohawk man, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Those guys were in bands that I grew up on.
They made a joke, though, I believe, with their acceptance speech of that, we are not young.
Are they like really new artists? They've been around for 12 years. Like, our friend Aaron has been fans of theirs for, like, 10 years.
Well, who was?
Our friend Aaron, who had been on the show before. She'd been fans of theirs since they were in Arizona.
Fun's only been around for, like, 4 years.
No, but they're the band members. I guess it was an earlier iteration of the band.
Well, there were a few. One was in a band called The Format, which is a very popular, like, indie, kind of like in the... punk scene, but not quite. It was this weird emo scene. But that another one, Jack Antonoff, he was in a band called Steel Train. And those bands, I mean, you can start bands at 16. So those guys are essentially, even though they're pushing 30, that's still relatively young. It's funny. It is funny that they did say that. But, you know, they don't bother me in the same way that a lot of other people don't bug me.
I'm not a big Mumford & Sons guy.
Those guys bore the fuck out of me.
I find everything to be the same.
I agree.
They're British. Did you know
this? Are they Irish?
Whatever, they're not from Tennessee, which is what I probably assumed.
Oh,
or
no,
Alabama.
I thought they were Irish. Like, you know, that's their whole thing is kind of an Irish thing, and you know, drunk group sing-alongs is kind of the idea, and it bores me to tears.
The Pogues had that cornered a long time ago.
Yeah,
oh, absolutely.
Say I'd rather listen to them.
Pogues are way better.
I mean, I guess maybe I'm just not overly excited about these people, but I know people who are. I know people, like you said, 28 billion people.
Yeah. All of China.
All of China watched the Grammys.
Well, here's why I like the Grammys, is because you get these, and I still remember watching some of these performances in the past where you get these epic collaborations between artists who would never share the stage together.
Absolutely.
And they create these really unique moments, and I just, that for me is what the Grammys are all about, is watching once-in-a-lifetime musical performances.
And there's usually the Grammys, usually music award shows, because you're dealing with male and female divas just across the board, there will always be a memorable freak-out moment of some sort. Something happens, whether it's at the Video Music Awards where Kanye interrupted Taylor Swift.
Yeah.
In this case, Adele apparently chewing out Chris Brown, which I want that photo on my wall.
She chewed out Chris Brown because he did not stand up when Frank Ocean won. Although I don't know, do we need to be giving Frank Ocean a standing ovation? But they did not. But either way, he was just sitting there. And he's,
well,
and here's the thing. Actually, you've given me a perfect segue. I want to get back to some Grammy stuff, but you give me too good of a segue.
Sure.
Which I'm ruining by talking about the segue.
Fair enough.
But Chris Brown, he has this beef with Frank Ocean. Like, Frank Ocean took his parking space. That was really it. He took his parking space, so he shouted gay slurs and threatened to shoot him.
Like you do.
You know, Chris Brown, we've talked about him on the show before. He was enemy of the podcast in the third episode a year ago.
I think he's enemy of the world, except for, you know, I mean, obviously a lot of people still really enjoy his music, but, you know, most people, it blows my mind that, you know, with all the, like, fits and all the things he's thrown, which he's like Bieber on overdrive.
He keeps throwing fits. He's smashing windows at Good Morning America. I mean, all these things have happened in the past year since we made him one of our first enemy of the podcast. Yeah. And guess what? It turns out he didn't even do his community service. He lied about it, supposedly. He's had to be in court. He faked the community service. So this guy, who got off easy, he got off so fucking easy for beating the hell out of Rihanna. Got off so easy to the point that she's still with him. He still gets Rihanna. Yeah. He still gets Rihanna. He doesn't do his community service. He's not standing up and applauding. He's threatening to shoot Frank Ocean. He is the worst. And that is why, Chris Brown, you are the first repeat offender for Enemy of the Podcast. Fuck you, Chris Brown. Fuck you. I can't stand this guy.
I agree with all of that 110%. Yeah.
And my big thing, and I said it a year ago, and it still hasn't happened, there's been no... I believe in second chances.
I do, too. Absolutely.
He's not...
No, but the you know, what's interesting is that the whole thing, I mean...
He hasn't repented.
Sure. He really hasn't. And he, I mean, you know, everyone saw the pictures that came out when the work he did on Rihanna. That's not... That's
arguably his finest album. No, I'm so sorry.
That was... Even comedians would say, whoa, that's dark.
There was a joke, I'll give credit to it.
Sorry,
Andrea. There was a line on... I think it was What Would Tyler Durden Do, where they said, and why was Chris Brown so upset? He was there with Rihanna, who looked great. Of course, looking great at the beginning of a date with Chris Brown is a lot easier than looking good at the end. That's when things get dicey.
Well, he, you know, basically the work he did on her, that's like, there's something inside his head that needs to be repaired. And someone from the outside is not stepping in and being like,
no,
let's...
Back to what we're talking about with Bieber living in this bubble, and Chris Brown also had a lot of success coming to him at a young age.
Yeah.
And can just get away with...
But I don't know if that... With Chris Brown, I guess this is the nature versus nurture debate, and
right.
I don't mean to take it to that level.
No,
but
please.
Like, you know, it is one of those things, like, there's a screw in there that has been from a very young age.
Right.
That if he was possibly born with, that needs to get fixed. Like, I don't know. Some of it is just, you don't know what's going on in his head, but that needs like, serious rehabilitation.
Well, just that some people are aggressive people, and how... Poor ways of expressing that.
Is he that good? Like, why is he nominated for awards? I mean, I got to admit, his kind. I think what is the category like? The category is like urban music or urban something.
R&B.
But the category.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, like
that's
urban.
Right. Yeah, I remember now.
Which somehow feels racist for me to say, but it's urban something. And is he, like, I don't really listen to a lot of that music. Is he that good? Is he so good that we should be rewarding him in any way?
I don't think so. But you know, the argument people try to put is put the art, ignore what the artist does. You know, it's just about the art itself.
Yeah.
That's, I think, the
common
argument.
Calling his stuff art?
Yeah, hey, some people do, you know? Some people do. I try to, like, just remember that, like, some people don't consider stand-up art, so I really try to, like, respect as much as I can, but it's really hard.
It is art.
Here's the thing, and I do completely prescribe to that school that you have to separate out the work from the man. In fact,
sure.
I just spoke about this.
You gave a speech about Wagner, an opera speech about Wagner. Anti-Semite.
Exactly. So, but here's the difference,
too. These are the conversations, by the way, that just rake in the pussy.
True story.
Wagner, how full is your calendar?
Pretty full. A lot of opera chicks.
Here's the thing. You go on stage and make jokes. This guy goes up, talks about Wagner.
There
so
we go. Is this for like? Are you a teacher?
Court-ordered community service. No, I also I do community education for opera.
Oh, that's really cool. That's like very specific.
That's very specific.
That's awesome though.
Yeah.
I think that's really cool because that is such a like niche thing. And my grandpa would totally be into it. I don't mean to be insulting.
That's fine.
But that's true.
Well, we're trying to take an old man genre and make it into...
Make it for the kids.
Bring it back for the next generation.
Bring it to the Chris Brown crowd.
To the Chris Brown crowd.
Well, I guess talking about this art form, I don't really know much about Frank Ocean, but apparently he has a song...
I know so much about Frank Ocean.
Well, let me ask you this, because apparently he has a song about Forrest Gump written from Jenny's perspective?
No.
What was that all about, then?
The song's called Forrest Gump. I mean, I guess it could be from Jenny's perspective as like what it's covering for, but no. He came out as either being bisexual or gay. He's never defined which of the two.
People say he still wants to get laid by women.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, he basically said...
Good for him.
Three songs on the album were written for male lovers. And Forrest Gump was one of them.
Okay.
And it's a fantastic song. It really is. Okay. That album is amazing. It deserves all the praise it's getting. I actually, his mixtape that he put out before that, I thought was phenomenal. That guy is going to be... That's the future of R&B right there.
All the more reason why you should have stood the fuck up, Chris Brown. Go fuck yourself. Yeah. I hope Adele called you the enemy of the podcast.
Well, you know, afterwards...
Well, what did you do? I didn't exactly see what went down.
There's just a shot of him kind of... He was literally sulking. Like, his eyes were watered. He was, like, very pouty that he lost to Frank Ocean. And... I guess you could see this. You see a few shots. One is of Frank Ocean walking up. You see Chris sitting there with his arms folded, and Adele turns over and sees him.
Yeah.
The next shot is of him kind of like pleading to her, like with these tears kind of like falling down his face, and her yelling. And then later on, there's a shot of them making up. Like you see them smiling for pictures together.
That.
But you know, she apparently said on Twitter, she said that like I just told him that something. You know, like hey, she said something apparently very nice. But suppose, you know, she's like a huge Frank Ocean fan. Like, she's tweeted about how much she loves him, his record. So I think she tried to cover up for what it was. But I think it was something along the lines of stop being a fucking little bitch.
It was probably some no-nonsense Brit talk.
Yeah, so it's Adele wisdom.
Yeah.
That'd be a great Twitter feed.
And it's something we're never – I wish – what I really wanted was I don't want anyone to go beyond what happened in the yelling. Like, I don't want to find out what she said. I also don't want her to rectify it on Twitter. I wanted to, like, those moments we're never going to have anymore because of social media. It's the only time it saddens me because 20 years ago, if that had happened, all we would know was that they yelled something and they would have kept it a secret and they would have ridden on that for so long.
She would have written a song about it a year later.
It would have been the military picture, you know, the picture of the guy in Times Square kissing his woman.
Yeah.
You never know the context of it, but it's beautiful in that moment, and I would have loved to have not known one.
One other thing I want to say about the Grammys, they had a militant dress code. They said there was going to be no side boob or exposed butt cheeks or sheer dresses. Thankfully,
we had two people that...
Well, we had a few people, quite a few. But thankfully, we have heroes like Katy Perry who don't listen to this.
And Alicia Keys, underboob.
Yes. Oh, you know what? Alicia Keys could do whatever she wants.
That Alicia Keys Maroon 5 performance worked surprisingly well.
It did, yeah. I'm
not a big Maroon 5 fan. Not terribly familiar with Alicia Keys' music.
They had one album I actually enjoyed, which I didn't think I would. Yeah. It was their second album. Their first one was their big
Maroon
one.
Maroon 2?
But yeah, Maroon 6.
Yeah.
I am the sixth Maroon 5.
Hold on. Okay.
And that album, I remember a friend of mine turned me onto it, and I was like, oh, this is actually good. I didn't love it, but I listened to it for a little while. I was like, oh, this surprised me.
Then you're like, oh, Adam Levine has terrible tattoos.
Yeah.
I mean, it seems to me kind of crazy that they want musicians of all people who are known for doing more edgier stuff coming. You know, you have people like, not that she was at this one, but like Lady Gaga who do these more, or Madonna back in the day.
Or the J-Lo dress, the green dress.
But even earlier than that, in rock and roll, people like Jim Morrison are on stage.
I think it's ridiculous to try and take that like Super Bowl 2004 approach where they're like, oh my god, a breast, we need to censor everything. Like, I don't get it because it's like now everybody has a sex tape. Everybody texts nude pictures to each other. Like, sex is there. Stop trying to put a Band-Aid on it, on a wound that does not exist.
Although, what if a woman just wore Band-Aids?
I'd love that.
That would be fantastic.
Next year, Lady Gaga. Actually, you know what I think Lady Gaga should do next year? Show up, no makeup, jeans and a t-shirt, Converse.
I think she's
the most radical thing she would ever
do. I had a conversation with someone about that. I said, you know what? At some point, she's going to put out some kind of album called, like, In Plain Clothes and literally just do a tour where she's just walking around in, like, a shirt and jeans.
She's going to be dressed like us.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's what I wouldn't put it past her at all.
Well, I salute Katy Perry's giant breasts, in all honesty. I mean, she was really putting them out there.
I saw her in person once. I saw it, not live, like performing. I did a show where Russell Brand was dropping in, and he's dropped in on three shows I've done, and she was only with him at one because after that they'd been divorced when he had dropped in at the other shows, and she was with him. They were it was at UCB, and it was really weird because it was like they were just sitting there eating dinner on the street like normal people, and they were not. Normally, paparazzi. Well, they usually eat inside because they want to hide from paparazzi. They were right on the sidewalk. No one was bothering them because it was in Franklin Village, which is I don't know why they call it Franklin Village. It's just one block and then Gelson's across the street. But like, yeah, that they were just eating at like Lava Bell or something, and then they came. They sat in the green room. They're very nice and they were really cool. And she was dressed, you know, very unassuming.
She's cute.
Fantastic. She looked great.
Okay. God bless you, Katy Perry, doing the Lord's work.
Honestly, you saved the Grammys red carpet for us all. before we wrap things up on this very exciting episode, Sean...
Was it exciting? I feel like I didn't punch in enough as a comedian.
You know what? You were really fascinating.
Oh, good,
thanks.
And you
brought up so many smart, interesting points.
Okay, good.
Completely alienated your entire fan base.
Fan base, correct.
Everyone who just thought you were some dolt who told jokes, yeah. Now they know
they got,
better.
And set things up for Russell Brand.
They got Lady Gaga in plain clothes.
Yeah. But before we exit, so maybe you do have some chances to punch up some
here,
stuff.
Here we
more.
Go.
Sean, they found Richard III... I didn't know he was lost. Why don't you, since you work for the opera, you're more intellectual than me, tell us about this.
Well, as we all know, Richard III died in 1485 at the Battle of Bosworth Field.
I did not know that, but keep going.
Basically, at his...
He died in battle.
He died in battle, and King Henry VII, who was the first of the Tudor kings who won that battle and had a very sketchy claim to the English throne, had the body of Richard III displayed to basically prove the king is dead, and then he quietly disappeared the body. And there were stories about where it ended up.
Oh, they just dug it up, right?
Is right. So this Richard III Society has been working.
Society.
It's a society, yes, and it's a crowdsource-funded society, might I add, because they lost all their funding. They did some research, and they basically found out that, based on the best of their knowledge, the body had been buried in a church in a monastery in Lancashire, England. And the problem was that all the monasteries had been destroyed when Henry VIII decided that he wanted his own religion. So using a lot of sophisticated modeling, they basically...
By the way, this trumps my opening about Los Angeles geography by a long shot.
I would agree.
So basically, they figured out that the spot of this monastery was basically in a parking lot, or as they call it, a car park. And they started digging some trenches, you know, to figure out, okay, where are we? See if we can figure out where the church was. The first trench they dug ran across the length of the church, and they found a body in that spot. And so they started figuring out, okay, this is, they found the outer walls, this is where the church was. They start excavating the body, they're bringing in experts, and they discover that the body seems to have a slight curvature to the spine. And so that's, you know, Richard III was famously known to have been a hunchback.
That I did know.
Yes, yeah, so they excavate the body, and they start having to do a number of tests. So one, they get the whole
skull out.
Well,
he was a hunchback, and he was riding in a horse in
battle.
Well,
so what they find out is that, so they start doing these tests on the body. So one thing they find is that the skull has scoliosis. It doesn't mean that he was a hunchback, but you could have scoliosis and basically look fairly okay, but you'd have like a droop shoulder or something because your spine is just kind of pulled to one direction.
It's just your anatomy.
So, yeah, it'd just be your anatomy. You look a little weird, but what's strange is that there are no real contemporary accounts of Richard III mentioning that he's a hunchback. That was like a later embellishment, because you have to remember the Tudor dynasty took over and they wanted to besmirch.
Well, of course.
Clearly.
Yes.
So they wanted to besmirch, you know, the last of the Lancastrian kings.
So they found him in this carport.
They find him. They find the skeleton, and a couple of interesting things. The skull had been, the cause of death was basically the back of the skull had been cleaved off in battle. It had a battle wound. He also had a nick on the skull.
Keep going.
So his brains had spilled out his back. Also, they found evidence that a dagger had been thrust through the top of the head when the body was in a kneeling position. But this is the best part. They found that the body had suffered from post-mortem humiliation wounds. Essentially, someone had jabbed a dagger up his ass because there was scoring on both the front and back of the pelvis. So,
and I just came.
Yeah, the body had basically been trussed over a horse, and someone jabbed a dagger up his ass. So how did they prove that it was Richard III? Interestingly enough, have traced the 17th generation great-nephew of his back to his sister. He's a carpenter in Canada, and running DNA testing, they matched the DNA of the skeleton to this only known living ancestor, and it was a match. So this was, in fact, the body of Richard III. And it's pretty fascinating.
It actually is. I mean, we're joking.
I know, but it is. we're joking because it's essentially one of those boring things possible.
But it's
kind of cool. No, it is, but it's one of those things like, you know what? We're all going to fucking die.
Yeah.
That's the way I honestly look at it. It's like you know, to me, it's honestly like when people say, like, spending all that money going to space, I think of the same thing on both. It goes both ways to me, you know what I mean? Like, I'm actually very interested in knowing what's going on in Mars, but at the same time, You know,
but don't you have a don't we have an obligation to future generations for exploration and science and
oh, I don't. You know. Yeah, absolutely. No, that's what I mean. Like with space, I'm a little more on board with it. Okay. But like, in terms of
you don't
want
to drudge up the past.
Right. Like, let's just the
one day someone's gonna dig you up and talk about your post-mortem humiliation wounds.
And let me tell you, it's gonna be there are a lot of emotional ones because I'm probably gonna eat my diary. That's I'm gonna die. I'm gonna eat my diary.
The cause of death was a large ingestion of some sort of pulp material.
And then they're gonna like do the excavation. And they're like, wait, these are words. Yeah. And they're just gonna be like,
dear
really
God, are you there? It's me.
Yeah, insecure. We got that word together. And they're like, I think we've done all the research.
Tear-stained pulp.
Future generations, I want them from this, from your body full of your diary. I want them to try to piece together what society was like.
Yeah, exactly. Well, this is just a cool story. And what makes it so fascinating is that they literally found the skeleton on the first trench they dug. And
that
it was just
actually,
an exploration trench. Right place. Right spot, dumb luck. This never happens.
But how come they can't find Jimmy Hoffa?
Jimmy Hoffa wasn't buried in a monastery in Lancashire, England.
Well, those guys also back in the day, pre-Hoffa. Let's call it the pre-Hoffa era.
The pre-Hoffa era.
And a couple other cool things they did when they carbon dated the skeleton. They had to compensate for the fact that this skeleton had a higher diet of animal protein and fish proteins, so they had to adjust for the carbon decay that would have been in fish and cow at the time.
What were you about to say about the pre-Hoffa days?
I was just going to say that, back then they were just like, let's just toss the body over here. They're not going to be able to do any homework on it. Now they're like, you know what? We should probably put the head in Canada, the arm in Seattle.
This is why in the future we need loopers.
Well, you know, Napoleon's penis was cut off and famously has traveled the world. I'm thinking of an idea for a new CSI show. CSI, Lancastrian England, which is like historical detectives. No?
Absolutely not.
Fuck.
Wow.
So yeah, well, they found Richard III.
That's show business, baby.
Yeah.
What does this mean for us, though? The Richard III thing. Does it mean anything?
It means if I ever go back to England, I got a new place to go visit.
Okay.
Yeah. What does it mean for us? Pretty much nothing.
Okay.
It really absolutely changes that. It changes
but it
nothing.
Is, it's
fills in a couple gaps in the historical record. He was only king for 2 years.
There's a guy somewhere, like a university professor, who's like drinking a glass of red wine and really excited about this. And also, he's also really sad because there's not a woman he can share this with.
Oh, and on that note.
On that note, Eli, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you guys. Thank you guys for having me. This was a lot of fun. I love talking pop culture. And I slightly enjoy talking about Richard III. And I really enjoy talking about LA geography.
I know. I think you should do a whole act on it.
I'm going to reinvent my podcast to just talk about that.
Okay. When you do, have me on and
absolutely.
I will explain the route I took to
it's
get
It's
going to
be called the 405 and the 101.
Yep. Yeah. Well, it's going to be called The Interchange.
The Interchange. Actually, it's not bad.
Yeah, because it's going to be about interchange.
Oh.
He's going to use the geography to heal people.
You know what he's going
to
do? We're going to come after him for money on that, and then he's going to come after Gaga when she comes out with her In Plain Sight album or In Plain Clothes.
That's going to be my record.
That's going to be
your
retirement
CSI
money. Lancaster.
Wait, that's going to be your retirement fund.
I'm actually going to do CSI Lancaster, California, and Palmdale. That's going to be where I cover.
It's a lot of meth.
Where can we find you again? Tell everybody one more time.
EliOlsberg.com, at EliOlsberg on Twitter, EliOlsberg on Facebook, and I'm at the Laugh Factory every other Wednesday at 10 o'clock, along with other spots there, and also at the Pleasure Chest in West Hollywood every other Tuesday.
In the video booth in the back, right?
They don't have those, but if they did, I totally would. But TJ Miller and I hang out in the front and do a show in the front.
Excellent.
Okay, and that's every other Tuesday?
Yes, you're thinking of the Valley, which is where we are.
Yes.
This is where all the
perverts it's every other Tuesday at 8, and it's only $7. It's free beer, and we always have people like Sarah Silverman, Marilyn Reiscub.
I love her, too.
She's on the next one. Who else is on the show? We've had on Doug Benson's done it. We have awesome drop-ins, so it's a great show.
We got to go.
We got to go to the show. Sean, do the thing where you plug.
Oh, sorry, and I just want to say it's $7, and it's free beer. You really can't beat that for that lineup.
No. $7 free beer, and Sarah Silverman, Doug Benson, people like this? Come on, if you don't go, you're
and a sex
asshole.
Shop. You can buy a glow-in-the-dark dildo.
Yeah, they give you 15% off afterwards, so you can get like a dildo for a little bit more than 10% off.
Sean, plug the thing where you plug things.
Once again, you can find me, TheSeanDavid, at Twitter. Instagram. You can buy my book, Triumvirs, T-R-I-U-M-V-I-R-S, at Amazon, Amazon Kindle. And I'm still waiting for you people to play me on letterpress.
Yeah, nobody's going to do that. It's too self-serving, even for a section where you plug things. I'm at The Real Will Link. You could also listen to me every Tuesday at 4 p.m. on The PM Show with Larry Minetti at crntalk.com. I review movies. I'll be reviewing Die Hard next week and tell you how awful it's going to be.
Yippee-ki-yay.
Yippee-ki-yay indeed. You want Con. You could read articles of mine there about films and stuff like that. Can, not Con. I'm an idiot.
Speaking of you want
Con. Speaking of, next week on the show, we were supposed to have her on all the way back in October. She was going to Skype in from New York, but then there was this hurricane, and then she didn't have power for a month, and then there was a blizzard, and she's been a mess. But we're going to have the lovely lady who runs that site, Madeline Costner, is going to be on. We're going to be talking some film with her. We're going to be talking some pop culture. We're going to have a good time. And then the week after that, we have Janelle Riley. She used to work for, or does she still, Backstage?
I believe so.
And she has interviewed everybody, and she's going to be on doing a little post-Oscar thing with us. She's got stories to tell. It's going to be great. She's the perfect guest for this. We're very excited. And we've been booking March. We've already got some funny people, some authors, some great people coming on board. So, you know,
one sexual pervert?
One, yeah.
Yeah. Confirmed sexual pervert.
And when...
What about the three on right now?
Oh, beef.
And with that, Eli, thank you once
again.
Thank
you, guys. Thanks, guys.
We're finished.
We're finished.